Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. A familiar voice on these airwaves as NPR's first full-time TV critic, Eric Deggans looks at issues both important, the coverage of the presidential campaign, for example, and important in a different way, how the fall lineup is coming together at the TV upfront, say. Deggans, the author of the 2012 book Race Baiter, was previously with the Tampa Bay Times for 2 decades. He's also written for the New York Times, Salon, CNN, The Washington Post, and many other outlets. He recently delivered a lecture at Siena College called Breaking Down the Wall, Decoding Media's Confusing Coverage of Race and Culture, and he stopped by WAMC Studios first. Eric Deggans, welcome to the Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
Give me a sense of what your lecture is like and what you're trying to get across to the students you speak with.
Well, this has been an election that has uniquely challenged the news media, I think. We have two candidates. Not only are they sort of historically unpopular, but they have very long track records with the media. And the way they've conducted their campaigns in different ways has challenged the traditional way of reporting the news, particularly when you're dealing with somebody like Donald Trump, who is willing to contradict himself even within the same speech and seems to not pay much of a political price for those contradictions. The traditional news model of finding out the facts, exposing hypocrisies, and then letting the audience decide hasn't necessarily been as effectual in terms of raising public consciousness about controversies or issues that may be surrounding the candidate. And Hillary Clinton dealing with the disclosures that have come from WikiLeaks and dealing with her own sort of historic closed nature in terms of dealing with the press. She's very reluctant to reveal herself to the press in ways that aren't very carefully stage managed. That has proven to be another kind of challenge for the news media. And it's resulted, I think, in, people's trust in the news media has lessened. We have historic lows in terms of trust of the news media. And it's forced some news outlets to find new ways of reporting. For example, CNN in its graphics at the bottom of the screen will sometimes fact check things that candidates are saying because there's so much confusing information coming from these people that it's easier to just fact check it in the graphic below what they're saying. And these are all things that we have never really seen before.
In recent days, especially, Donald Trump has been claiming that the media, as a monolith, in his terminology, is out to get him and it's rigged against him. Do you see any truth to those accusations on his part?
I actually think there's been a sort of complex dynamic going on with Trump in that when he was running in the primaries, of course, it was a huge field. It was something like 16 or 17 contenders at one point. And so his celebrity and the sort of bombastic nature of what he was saying got him through that primary race without a lot of the kind of vetting, the kind of journalistic vetting that a candidate normally gets when they're starting their primary run for president. When you have a Democratic primary where there may be, three people running and only two of them are realistic shots at winning the nomination, you get a lot more journalistic vetting of those three people. When you have 16 or 17 people and one of them is somebody who's been a reality TV star for many years and has been famous for decades, he had a built-in advantage, and I don't think he got the kind of really close-in journalistic look that candidates normally get at that stage of the game. So once he won the nomination, then we started to see news outlets really take a hard look at his foundation, at his business claims, at the records that he had released or not released pertaining to his health and his finances, his taxes. And then, of course, he seemed to put the issue of sexual assault on the table, both through this this video that Access Hollywood found from 2005 where he seemed to be boasting about sexually assaulting women. And then the very next day 2 days after that video came to light, he brought these accusers who had accused Clinton of sexual improprieties to a press conference, not long before the second debate. So it seems odd that he's complaining now that news outlets are digging into the question of whether or not he may have sexually assaulted women, when he seemed to put that issue on the table in a couple of different ways not very long ago. I think he's getting the kind of journalistic vetting now that he really should have gotten in the primary process and would have gotten if there were fewer candidates. And, it is not a pleasant process, and I don't blame him for reacting to it.
One of the complaints we hear at WAMC a lot is you guys should stop talking about Donald Trump so much. This is what created his candidacy in the first place. To which we say, that may be, that may not be, but he is the Republican presidential nominee, and we're going to talk about the Republican presidential nominee.
Yeah, so, that horse is out of the barn now.
Right.
I think that was an argument that maybe you could have made early in the primary process when it wasn't clear that he had a shot at winning the nomination. But, when you have a field of 16 or 17 people and there's one person who is clearly out in front of that pack, you kind of have to talk about him. Now, how you talk about him, I think, is very important. And there's a concern out there that by treating some of the things he does as sort of typical campaign strategy, we are normalizing a behavior from political candidates that we've not seen before. To have a vice presidential candidate in a debate constantly be presented with actual statements from his running mate and have him say that they didn't happen when there's evidence that they did happen, when they're on tape, when they're on video, when they're on audio, to treat that as something that is just part of a political strategy. I can see people being concerned that would normalize that behavior. And the next time we have an election, we'll have to deal with politicians who feel free to actively deny things that are obviously true. But we're at a point now, unfortunately, where we're down to two realistic candidates for this job. And it's, the job to be leader of the free world. So, if you're a news outlet at this point and you're not talking about Donald Trump, you're really not doing your job.
Let's bring in the topic of race here. It's something you've thought a lot about and written about before. Put that in context of the coverage of the presidential campaign for us.
Well, and I'm sure you guys run into this, too. I am frustrated that people use this term, the media, to refer to all of us as if we're all doing the same thing. And in point of fact, different types of media operate very differently. What you guys are interested in, what we're interested in public radio is much different than what CNN might be interested in or what CNN might find a compelling story. And that's different than how the Washington Post and the New York Times print outlets would tell a story. So, with all of that sort of in mind, I would say that there's been some interesting coverage about racial issues in the middle of all of this, but it has been hard for that coverage to find a lot of attention because we are so focused on the horse race between these two people running for president. Mm. Of course, people of color are very concerned about the ways in which various types of non-white people have been vilified in the course of this campaign. To have Donald Trump start his campaign by calling, Mexican immigrants rapists, and then to have him retweeting, images from that seem to be popular amongst white supremacist websites and white supremacist, Twitter handles, and to have him advocate a total ban on immigration of people of a certain religion, of the Muslim faith, one of the largest, if the largest faith in the world. these kind of things are troubling to people. But there's also an undercurrent underneath that, a sense that we're having a hard time figuring out our multicultural future as a nation. And there is some good journalism sort of trying to speak to that. But I have a feeling that we're not going to be able to pay attention to those stories until the dust settles from this election. And we really do have to pay attention to those issues because, there's a lot of fear in some quarters about where our nation is headed in terms of our multicultural future. But, I'm a strong believer that's one of our strengths as a nation, the fact that we have so many different people dedicated to the same ideals of freedom and prosperity and hard work and achievement. And to have people of color coming here, and Muslims and people of different faiths coming here, all sort of dedicated to that ideal, that's always been our strength. And so we have to find a way to sort of get past the fear and harness the advantages that come from multiculturalism and having a browner, a blacker, a more religiously diverse nation. And we will. I'm convinced that we will do that. But first, we have to sort of get past the fear, and we have to sort of get past the raised emotions of an election.
We're speaking with Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, the first full-time TV critic in the network's history. Let me ask you one more political question, and then we'll talk about some TV. Were you working in Florida during 2000?
I was indeed. I was the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times newspaper. Now it's called the Tampa Bay Times newspaper. I was active there. I covered. There was a huge attempt by the media to recount all the ballots in Florida after the Supreme Court decision that made George W. Bush president. And I covered the details of that. I was there. I was at Ground Zero.
The reason I ask is so many people have said, well, this is like an election we've never had before in 2016. And then I keep thinking about 2000 and just how nuts that was.
Right. But that was nuts in a different way. I guess that's sort of, we've seen this progressive rising partisanship and this idea that just when you think people can't get more partisan, just when you think there's boundaries they won't cross, we have another election and people seem to cross them. I mean, the 2000 election was very notable. I mean, you know, we had a confusing ballot in Palm Beach County that seemed to lead people who were intending to vote Democratic to vote for Pat Buchanan instead or another candidate instead. We had a punch card system that was difficult to determine the will of the voter. And of course, anybody who was, paying attention at that time, was around at that time, knows the phrase hanging chads, you know, those little hanging tabs of paper that don't always come off. And so that caused a lot of confusion. And, the Secretary of State in Florida was a Republican. She had people working out of her office who were working for George W. Bush, and that was controversial. In the end, when the media, the Associated Press, the St. Petersburg Times, several news outlets got together, looked at all the ballots and determined that the butterfly ballot had so distorted the results of the vote in that county that the only way that Al Gore could have won Florida and thus won the presidency would have been if you took every questionable ballot and awarded it to him. And that wouldn't have happened. So in the end, with the ballots that were left, you know, George W. Bush did win Florida. And that was a tough thing, I guess, for some people to accept. But in the end, we did sort of come to a resolution and understand why the vote was so crazy. And, you know, it was a very close election. And Ralph Nader took, I think, about 10% of the vote in that state. A lot of people think those votes would have gone to Al Gore if he hadn't been in the race. And so, you know, there's a lot of elements there that would seem to apply to the race that we have now, except Donald Trump seems to be having trouble extending his popularity beyond his base. And the election may not be as close in Florida if the polls are accurate.
How much TV do you have to watch as the TV critic for NPR?
How many hours are there in a day? 22 hours out of 24. No, I do have to watch a lot of television. The thing that's great about modern technology is that I have an iPad and I have an iPhone and I have a laptop. And so I have all these screens that travel with me all the time. So, for example, on Saturday, if anybody's in the D.C. area, I'm going to be interviewing Taraji P. Henson, the star of Empire for the Smithsonian. And I was able to watch some of her work on my iPad while I was flying out here for these appearances. And so it's much easier to keep up with the job with the modern technology that we have. And I do indeed have to watch a lot of television. There were over 400 scripted series on television last year. possibly twice as many unscripted series on television last year. Huh. So that's a lot to keep up with. And I have developed a system for prioritizing my viewing. And surprisingly, I'm not like watching TV every waking moment, but sometimes it feels like I am.
What's the system?
The system is to ask myself, what kind of stories can I tell about the shows that I'm thinking about watching? And so I want to watch shows that are groundbreaking. I want to watch shows where there's some great story behind how that program got to the air. I want to watch shows that I think are going to be popular, that I think a lot of people will be watching. And I want to watch shows that say something about the direction of the outlet that is featuring the show. So if Amazon is doing a TV series from Woody Allen, I want to take a look at that, because it's not only notable that it's Woody Allen's first TV show that he scripted and directed and stars in, it's also notable that Amazon ponied up the money and the resources to get this, well-known director to come to television for the first time.
But you didn't, if I heard right in your review, you weren't a fan of it.
Yeah, and like, well, I can't think of any critics who really liked it. You know, it seemed obvious from what Woody Allen said in the few interviews that he gave before the show came out, that he was not that enthusiastic about doing television. And once you saw it, you got a sense that he just sort of wrote this really long movie and kind of chopped it up into six pieces. And so that was a problem. And then he was rehashing kind of old ideas, and that was a problem. He didn't challenge himself when he did this series. And it's unfortunate. As I pointed out in my review, I think if he could have made a couple of different casting choices, in particular, if he would have made Miley Cyrus's character African-American, I think it would have changed the entire debate. I mean, for people who haven't seen it or read about it, it's a period piece. It's set in the 60s. Woody Allen is playing a very kind of a complacent sort of mediocre novelist who's thinking about writing for television. And the war is raging. The civil rights movement is raging. And Miley Cyrus plays revolutionary who escaped from jail during the jailbreak. A police officer was shot. She's a wanted woman. And she knows Woody Allen's character's wife. And that wife agrees to give her shelter for a while and try to help her escape to Cuba. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing amongst the mostly wealthy, mostly liberal main characters and their friends about the state of things. But they don't really take very effective action. And there's a sense that the ultimate message of the series felt like, you know, when you're in those kind of tumultuous times and you're a comfortable, wealthy, liberal, the most you can do is sort of wring your hands and do things that are kind of ineffectual and madcap and zany. You know, like the wife has a book club that started reading, communist works, and they wanted to have a naked sit-in, at the draft board. And it was just, you think about a filmmaker who was alive during those times, who was rubbing shoulders with people like Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor and contemporaries of folks who were on the front lines of pushing boundaries about how we talked about these issues back then. And now he's in this powerful position. He's handed all these resources. He's got some of the best stars working with him, and, you know, people willing to take bit parts to be in a Woody Allen production. And this is what he does with it. It was so disappointing.
How do you think we'll be watching TV in 5 or 10 years from now? You mentioned all the screens you have. People are cutting the cord. You know, do you think the Netflix, Amazon, HBO Go model is here to stay, or are we going to move on to something new?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's foolish to try and predict what will happen in 5 years, because I don't think anybody predicted where we would be now. I remember, 3 years ago, being on the radio with another journalist from a trade publication, and that journalist insisted that the cable companies would keep control of their channel array and keep forcing people to buy and pay for channels that they don't watch. And I had this sense that the media industry is increasingly forced to cater to the wishes of the audience. There's so much competition for viewers and eyeballs. And the technology is constantly transferring power to the audience. It's so easy to start a Hulu subscription or stop it and start a Netflix subscription, to go onto Twitter and complain about something that appeared on NBC and get a bunch of people to join you, to go onto a Facebook page of a radio station that said something you don't like and get a bunch of friends to provide a stream of comments that make it look like the station is not doing its job. You know, the audience has so much power nowadays that the media structure has to cater to their will more and more and more. And so I think the only prediction I feel safe in making is that that's going to continue, and that what people want, what the audience most wants, television will find a way to give it to them. And then once one company finds a way to give the viewer what they want, all the other companies have to figure out how to do that, or they're going to get left in the dust. And nobody wants to miss out on the next innovation that's going to revolutionize the TV industry. And we all know that we're sort of at a very transformative moment, and that there's a lot of experimentation going on right now. There's a lot of different kinds of TV being made, and it can be found in a lot of different places. You know, you can pay for YouTube Red, you can watch Hulu, you can see TV on a bunch of different platforms and a bunch of different screens. And I think trying to predict where all of that is going it doesn't make any sense. But I do think the will of the audience is going to become more and more and more important, and figuring out what they want before they know they want it is going to be the most important quality that any TV executive has in the next 5 to 10 years.
And just for the network, sports used to be the great firewall against all of that. Reports lately show the NFL ratings are down, which is hard to believe in America. Do you see that chipping away at all?
Yeah, well, again, you know, we see, for example, Twitter is telecasting several Monday night football games, or Thursday night football games, and that's free. You know, so if you want to see, in the past, if you wanted to see an NFL game, it was impossible to find it legally on an online platform that wasn't paid for in some way, that you didn't have to pay a subscription fee or pay some kind of fee to access. Now Twitter is presenting, I think, 8 games for free. So that is starting to break down that hallowed sort of status that sports broadcasting has had in television, where it's the ultimate moneymaker and it's the ultimate thing that people will pay for. We're finding even now, again, the audience's will is starting to be felt even there. The audience is getting tired of paying for a cable subscription and having $4 or $5 or $6 or $7 of it going to sports rights in the form of fees that these cable providers pay to have ESPN, to have NBC Sports, to have CBS Sports Network. You know, the audience is tired of paying those fees. They want to access the sporting contest that they want to see, and they want to pay as little money as possible to do that. And Twitter has found a way to give people a taste of the NFL online for free. And so how much longer is it going to be before another online provider figures out a way to give them access to more sports for free? I think all of these sports packages that these providers have paid tons of money to access, that's going to be problematic for them going into the future. And we could see a serious sort of reevaluation of the profitability of companies like ESPN and, you know, NBC Sports Network, CBS Sports Network, Fox Sports Network. They all have these 24-hour sports channels now. And now they look like they may not have been the smart investment that they looked like even 3 or 4 years ago.
Last question. Favorite show currently?
Wow. I mean, I just said there were 400 shows on television. You want me to pick one? I am not that dumb. But what I will tell you is what I'm watching now. Okay, so I got an eye on Designated Survivor. I will admit that this is a show that I kind of missed because I thought the pilot was kind of obvious. This is the ABC show that stars Kiefer Sutherland as sort of a nebbishy, about-to-be-fired member of the cabinet who winds up becoming president because he's the designated survivor. I guess a lot of people didn't know this, but, you know, they talk about it every State of the Union. When they have a State of the Union and it draws together all the people from government, they have one person from the cabinet who is sits in an undisclosed location because if there's some calamity, if a bomb falls on the Capitol building or something happens and everybody's killed there, at least there's one person left who can carry on as president. And that happens. The Capitol building explodes. Almost everyone in it is killed. This lowly cabinet member who is going to be fired by the president after the State of the Union winds up becoming president. It is not incredibly realistic, of course, but it is an interesting drama. And Kiefer Sutherland, I've always underestimated his value as a TV star. People really like watching this guy on television. And so that's a show I'm watching, Pitch on Fox, the show about the first woman to compete in Major League Baseball. I love the show. It's struggling a little bit in the ratings, but it's really well done and not nearly as predictable as you might think. The Walking Dead comes back to new episodes on Sunday, and we have a key scene. A character named Negan appears. People who read the graphic novel already know how dangerous this character is, and he kills someone from the core cast of the show. It has not been revealed who it is, and they will not let critics see an advance screener of the episode, so even we don't know who's been killed. And of course, fans are waiting to see what happens there. That show's been picked up for another season before its latest season even starts, because it's the highest rated show on television amongst the highest rated, highest rated show on television amongst viewers 18 to 49, which is an audience cohort that advertisers love. So I'm loving, there's this whole array of shows that feature black culture and black people in new and creative ways, from Atlanta on FX to Insecure on HBO to Queen Sugar on the Oprah Winfrey Network, and Luke Cage on Netflix. So I'm watching all of that stuff in addition to watching all the new stuff that's going to be coming up in the rest of the year.
Well, Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic, and he stopped by to see us here at WAMC Studios. We'll give you a chance to get back to your viewing. Thank you so much for stopping in.
Always a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.